So suffice to say that our master said very little about Gehenna and Gan Eden. He talked about Gehenna a lot more than Gan Eden. He would warn people, stay out of Gehenna. He would usually end a parable in which there was a bad example with the guy ending up getting thrown into Gehenna, that sort of thing. But he never really takes time to describe Gehenna and Gan Eden. He mentions them more offhandedly, even in these parables and that sort of thing. He never takes time to explain the concepts. And it's puzzling. That's puzzling, because they seem like pretty big concepts. And the apostles never take the time to explain the concepts either, if you notice. Paul never says, and let me tell you about the delights of heaven. And let me write to you about the pangs and fears of hell, right? Why is that? I mean, it seems like a big oversight. Something as important and fundamental as the afterlife, the entire concept of reward and punishment in the afterlife, never explained. Only mentioned offhandedly with remarks and comments like, there will be gnashing of teeth. Or, better to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into Gehenna. These are disturbing things to say, especially when you don't know what Gehenna is. He'll be cast into outer darkness, the master says. The worm does not die. The fire is not quenched. These kind of comments. He drops these little statements as if we already know what he's talking about. It reminds me of the baptism problem. You know the baptism problem. Baptism is fundamental to Christianity. It's a rite, a sacred rite of Christianity. John the Baptist baptizes people. Jesus gets baptized, tells his disciples to baptize. Peter says, baptism now saves you. It's really, really important. But the New Testament writers completely forget to tell us what it is. Do you notice that? They don't tell us what baptism is, how it's done, what it represents, or how it functions. They just say, baptized. Why would they omit something so critical and so fundamental? And look at the results. Years of deep and bitter feuds over the method, meaning, and significance of the rite of baptism. Why would they omit important information like this? And the answer is that they assumed that we already knew that because it was already a standard part of Jewish practice. Something that everyone was practicing in Judaism already, because Judaism had the rudiments of baptism already, so they would feel no more the need to describe baptism to their readers, the New Testament writers, then the modern novel writer would feel the need to explain to his readership what a cell phone is before describing one of his characters using a cell phone. It's just something that was obvious, okay? When it comes to the afterlife, and particularly the soul in paradise or Gehenna, you have the same thing at work. The same as the baptism problem. Yeshua and the apostles, they don't come to start a new religion. They're not teaching in a vacuum. They are taking it for granted that people already know what they're talking about and understand the basic concepts of Pharisaic theology, such as the existence of the undying soul, the existence of Sheol, the existence of Gehenna and Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. All right, so there's one particular place that's an exception to the rule. And that is Luke chapter 16, where the master does offer a unique glimpse into Gehenna and Gan Eden. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus, which you'll find in Luke 16, beginning in verse 19. In the Deilich, Hebrew, it's going to be page 283. Verse 19, there was once a rich man. He was dressed in purple and fine linen and enjoyed delights and rejoiced every day. A poor man named Lazarus was laid at the opening of the gate of his house, and he was full of blisters. So we have a certain rich man. Here's the setup. The certain rich man who's living in luxury. It's his custom to wear garments of purple and fancy underwear. And there's a starving beggar named Eliezer who lays near his door. Lazar is short for Eliezer, Lazar. You add the Greek masculine suffix and enters into English then as Lazarus. So Lazarus longs to eat from his table. It says he craved to be satisfied from the bits that fell from the rich man's table. The dogs would even come and lick his blisters. The dogs treat him then as if he's already dead. They treat him as if he's already dead. I find it interesting that the parable doesn't mention, now in this description of Lazarus that we're reading here, the parable doesn't say anything about whether he was particularly pious, nor does it say that he confessed a particular creed. It only indicates that he was a Jew who suffered disproportionately in life. It goes on. When the poor man died, the angels carried him to Abraham's lap. The rich man also died and was buried. So finally, the beggar dies, and he's carried by angels. That's how the NASB translates it. It says, carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. Abraham's bosom. The DHE translates it as Abraham's lap, Abraham's lap. What is Abraham's bosom? The one traditional Christian explanation understood Abraham's bosom, Abraham's lap, as limbus partum that I described in the first lecture, that is, the limbo of the fathers that we discussed earlier. So it's this waiting room on the edge of hell where all the Old Testament saints get penned up and wait for Christ's resurrection. So he ends up there waiting for the resurrection. So according to that reading, he's not in paradise. He's not in Ganadan. He's on the edge of, he's somewhere on the edge of hell.